must wear my mask and wash my hands after going home.
It's a good tuna, but I think I paid too much.
I am the king of the reek.
Welcome to the Japan What Podcast, episode 139. I am your host, Matthew PM Bigelow.com. This is the podcast, of course, coming at you from the Tomihisacho Studios in Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan. The armpit of Asia. Covering AI markets, Japan society 5.0, rising conflict in the Indo-Pacific, migration, depopulation, and more. We welcome you to the show. The cherry blossoms are about to open up. We are in peak plum season now, and it's quite nice to walk past the temples in Tokyo and see the ume blossoms in full bloom with birds mucking about up in the branches there. Getting into the flowers, are they after the nectar? I'm not sure what the birds are doing with the flowers, but it's certainly nice to see after the long, cold winter. A couple of snowfalls later, and we're moving into spring. Hopefully everybody is rocking and rolling and keeping it real in the free world out there. All right, let's begin today's show. We're very busy today, and we're just going to jump right in. We're going to cover some tech and some immigration and some other things like that. And let's stay in the world of the grown-ups. We don't cover anime. We don't do the whole manga thing here, although I'm not against it. I just wouldn't know what to say about it. Although I'm pretty sure I could say anything about it and it would be more popular than what I'm talking about on the weekly or by two times a week basis. Anyways, so let's begin. Coming to us from japantoday.com, Swiss and Japan scientists create glass that generates electric current. Oh yeah. Japanese and Swiss scientists have created glass that creates an electric current when exposed to light, an innovation they hope could lead to the production of clean energy in the long term. The researchers at the Tokyo Institute of Technology and the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, tit and swit, Technology Lausanne, Swiss Federal Institute of Technology Lausanne, tit and Fittle confirmed that the generation of a current on the glass after they etched a circuit into its surface with a femtosecond laser, which emits ultra-short pulses of light. I've studied this technology before as well. Microsoft was kind of big on it, not for the generation of electricity, but for the storage of data by pulsing light into glass at certain levels and at certain speeds with configurations in the light, it would be able to act as memory chips in the glass. It's an amazing idea, but of course, it's glass, so it's a material that's available all over the place, but nobody really has a femtosecond laser, and not really many people have the devices that could decode the femtosecond glass etchings. But yeah, Microsoft was big into this because you could essentially create massive data banks of storage that would require little to no electricity or management to store them. They're just glass tablets, essentially. Reminds me of the ancients, the scrolls, and the Sumerians with their tablets and all that, in a way, doesn't it? Are we coming full circle here? But, you know, 10 times the amount. Their discovery was reported on the website of the U.S. science magazine Physical Review Applied in January. Is that the name of the science magazine? Physical Review Applied in January? Oh, that's a weird name for a magazine. Why not phrase it like this, journalists? Their discovery was reported in January on the website of the U.S. science magazine Physical Review Applied. Or you could also say their discovery was reported on the website of U.S. science magazine Physical Review Applied. And then don't put in January in there. The January discovery, you could, you know, something like that. Anyways, Yves Belouard, an associate professor at the Swiss School and director of its Galatea Lab, told Kyoto News that the technology is, quote, surprising and innovative, unlike your quote, as it can transform a material without adding anything. According to the expert on laser technologies, a student in his laboratory named Gözden Torun had prior experience using a femtosecond laser on a different type of glass, including telluride glass, an industrial substance used to make optical fibers. The collaborative project involved using telluride glass prepared by the Japanese Institute. During the research, Torun, who earlier studied at Japan's Tohoku University, created a semiconductor crystal on the glass by accident. With a laser-inscribed circuit on its surface, the telluride glass generated an electric current in reaction to ultraviolet and visible light, the researchers said. Quote, "We didn't expect to see that kind of phenomenon by using lasers," end quote, said Tetsuo Kishi, an associate professor at the institute. Continuing the quote, "The glass is a passive material which just lets through the light. But after using a femtosecond laser, the glass changes to an active material which can transmit electrical current like a semiconductor," end quote, Kishi said. Quote, "We could change the shape of the glass and make it lighter and thinner by altering the composition so that it could be more useful and practical," Kishi added. "Although challenges remain, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba." So it's kind of a neat idea, perhaps in the future, we have glass with laser etchings on them and that provides energy to us all. So instead of having to wire the copper and into all the houses and stuff like that, you just have a light and you put down a piece of glass and it like I can power my laptop, you know, bring on the porn or whatever. But instead of, oh, I have to plug in my computer to wank it, you know, that old gag. But we could be entering into some very interesting breakthroughs. Of course, the idea is that, well, if this technology has been around forever, actually, but they already bought it and they stored it. And now that their hold on the world is getting weak, they want to introduce this next technology to bring us all into their next form of new world order. And, you know, I always say, probably, maybe not, I don't know. Put that information on the back burner, but it's interesting to think about, isn't it? Oh, here's the next wave of technology, and surprise, it's being supported by all the big banks and the corporations. Now your payment will be associated with it. I'm actually going to include a video from Microsoft of the femtosecond laser pulse glass memory storage devices. Because it's hard to explain, but it looks, the finished product is remarkably simple, but to get it to that stage requires an insane level of R&D and application. And it's not just the engineer like thinking about ways to make your algorithm more psychographically motivated to convince you that you suck and you need to buy more stuff. These are people like etching data into glass using lasers. It's incredible. So I'll be including that on the website for the podcast, MatthewPMBigelow.com. And, you know, I always make sure to put all the links and some photos up there as well, just as a reference point for people who want it or need it. But also some people will be like, hey, you're just a weirdo conspiracy theorist. I'm like, that's a half-truth. That's a half-baked half-truth. But you can go to the website and look at all the links that we're talking about there. And then you can go post on some other forum somewhere how you think it's racist. That's fine by me. Just keep it out of my head. I don't need it. So MatthewPMBigelow.com. And that's today's first segment that I like to title, It's WTF WUT. Why not, huh? Let's go. Moving on to Japan Society 5.0.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society. Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom. Society 5.0, a technology-based, human-centered society. Industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face. It will, for example, free us from the stress of driving, allowing us to safely visit anyone.
So Japan Society 5.0 is the Japanese government umbrella term for all things AI, and it reflects the process of a society, how 1.0 would be hunter-gatherers or something like that. And we're in 4.0 right now, the data PC society. And 5.0 refers to kind of humans interfacing with AI and cloud networks in real time to do whatever they want to do. And I include it as an umbrella term because it's not just an AI product or it's not just a flying car, but it's the Japanese government's envisioned plan for its future. It's also working with Thailand in some degree on this as well. Thailand has a similar idea. And the idea behind Society 5.0, which as you could hear with that initial promo video, was from 2016-17-ish, and a lot has changed since then. A lot of the things that they promised have not come to fruition, drone delivery, all of that stuff. And instead, it's kind of moved a lot into SDGs and bureaucracy and regulatory movements. But on the other hand, the spirit of Society 5.0 remains very much alive in a lot of the startup culture and in a lot of areas of Japan that aren't under the direct thumb of so much bureaucratic control. In Fukuoka, for example, would be one area, some areas in Hokkaido as well. And that's because you combine like the idea that, like, Tokyo has the emperor. It has the main governments. It also has the municipal government, which is very powerful, the Tokyo municipal government. Then it has like the Tokyo universities, and all the corporations are here. It's pretty full, and it's full of big fish. And the little fish get eaten up pretty quickly and kind of disappear. Like, kind of like I mentioned, you know, that technology gets eaten up and it disappears. And is it because that they want to roll it out when their systems fail and they want us to continue being their slaves in one way or another? Well, that's one idea to say it. But the other idea is that they see value, and young people can make millions of dollars off of their innovations by kind of future prepping it inside of an organization that would be more capable of delivering it. So, you know, we have all these different ways of looking at it. And of course, I spent 5 years as an AI teacher at a telecommunications company in Tokyo, of all things and of all things to do. As an English teacher, but researching AI products for their engineering team. The company had been investing $100 billion into the AI field at that time. And anyways, I kind of followed it that way and have since been following it via the podcast on a weekly basis. So I consider myself one of the country's leading experts in terms of AI markets in Japan and where the Japan Society 5.0 is progressing as a whole. I don't really see anybody else covering it. And again, the reason why I cover it is because, like, we want to change the society and everything, and we're the government, and we're going to try our best to do it. It's like, okay, I might try to understand what you're trying to do there, because a lot of the times you're not very good at it. But this is just an idea that I like for the time being, and it's simplicity that hopefully just works. This comes to us from the Mainichi, Japan's national daily since 1922. And this is Tokyo Subway installs clear translation screen before 2025 events. I've covered such technology before, and it seems to be spreading. The amount of tourists flocking into Japan is crazy right now. The low yen is bringing in so many tourists. And oddly enough, most of the tourists coming in these days are not native English speakers or even European types. It's mostly Asians, Taiwan, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, Thai as well. There's still a lot of European stock coming in, Canadians or whatever, Americans too. And if you're like a European descent like me, in Japan, you tend to stick out like snowflakes on a beach, on a yellow sandy beach. Get it? But a lot of the tourists, if you're from Asian countries, there is distinctions, but not quite as much or as harsh, like the height difference, the hair difference, the eye color difference, I can tell a lot of Asian people apart pretty quickly, but that's if I'm looking. Like, if you're looking at 500 Asian people from very different cultures, they will, of course, be behaving very differently. But if they all have black hair, kind of, you know, Asian skin, and they're roughly 160 to 170 centimeters, and their clothing is kind of demure. You're gonna be like, well, nah, that just looks like a bunch of Asian people to me. And you could also say the same thing, like, would Asian people be able to like look down a street and say, that's a French person, that's a German person? Oh, look, the Nordic features on that person make me believe he's from Norway. That doesn't happen either. So it sounds racist when it goes one way, but it doesn't sound racist at all when it goes another way. It's because Asian people don't really care that much. But anyways, what we have here is a translation screen. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because we can expect some sort of English ability between Japanese people understanding maybe American English or British English or something like that. But it's kind of hard to expect Japanese people in subways to understand Chinese English accents or Indian English accents or Thai English accents all in the same day if you're in a high volume situation such as a subway. And you have people asking the same question, but very differently with different words and different pronunciation and different accents and things like that. One key difference that separates Japanese English from a lot of other Southeast Asian language English is the pronunciation is very different. Because of Japanese katakana pronunciation, a, i, u, e, o, kaki, kuke, ko, rari, ru, re, ro, and so on. I'm not sure. We call it katakana pronunciation, but it makes English words longer. Like party is party, and homoskuru, it makes the English words longer. But because of like Chinese derivative languages or Thai derivative or Vietnamese, it often makes the English words very short. Because of just their native language. So it's like high school. It might be like a Thai or a Taiwanese way of saying, let's go to party. And it's very quick and stuttered. But in Japanese, let's go to party. It'd be very long. So they're not really equipped to deal with each other's English at all. So a clear translation screen in a busy area such as a subway would be like a Japanese society 5.0 approach to facilitating the influx of travelers instead of always having to rely on, you know, some person in a subway who's an expert on the English languages of 15 different, you know, Southeast Asian countries. You know, I've been to ASEAN many times, all the ASEAN conferences, and I listen to their webinars and I'm so fluent with understanding all these different types of Asian English. Like, that's nobody except me. The Tokyo Metropolitan Government, this comes to us from Kyoto News, and we're recording this on March 11th. Oh, yeah, the anniversary or the day that the tsunami Fukushima meltdown occurred. I was in Japan at the time. Scary stuff. We're not going to go into it today. You can just Google it, blah, blah, blah. So the Tokyo Metropolitan Government has installed a transparent translation screen covering 12 languages at a subway station to help foreign visitors ahead of global sporting events in the Japanese capital next year. This was published on March 9th, 2024. Sorry about that. The system developed by Toppan Holdings, Inc., equipped with a keyboard, translates between Japanese and English, Chinese, Spanish, and other languages. The transparent display, set up on a trial basis at the end of February at the Oedo Line's Tochomai Station in Shinjuku Ward. Tochomai is the station for the Tokyo Metropolitan Government building, and it attracts quite a few people. But the reason why it's probably located there is so that the municipal government has a tight view on it. Anyway, so it's installed in Shinjuku Ward, allows individuals to see facial expressions while reading subtitles on the screen, aiding communication, an official of the Tokyo government said. Similar screens were installed at the Seibu Railway Co.'s Seibu Shinjuku Station and some tourist information services counters in Tokyo last year. Some retailers, including the Takashimaya department store in Osaka, have also installed the screens in response to the increasing number of foreign visitors. The screens can display subtitles for both spoken and typed words, so people with hearing and speech impairments can also communicate with railway staff, the Tokyo government said. I'm very strong these days for Japan Society 5.0 on barrier-free or aiding the disabled. because it keeps the focus of the technology clear instead of, because oftentimes like it's going to be AI and then it could be large language model and then people can chat with it. And then, oh, why don't we, if people love the Japan Trail Networks, they can talk to it like it's a friend and it will tell them all the stories of the train lines. And it becomes a yes and into a point where it's like, it's just unclear. But if it's like, no, people are busy and they have hearing impairments and speech impairments and movement impairments, the system has to be set up in a way to interface with those types of people to get them to where they need to go as quickly as possible. And then it just kind of cuts off, it sets some very clear parameters of where the software needs to go. Anyways, the system set up at Tochomai Station also translates between Japanese and Korean, Vietnamese, French, and Portuguese. So that's just an idea. I think that clear translation screen is nice. There's a person behind it, so you're not just interacting with a chatbot, and it translates into the language you need, and then you're off on your merry way. I think this is a giant win, and I'd like to see more of it in the future. Next, we're going to take a look at my alumni, the good and the bad of SoftBank and Japan Society 5.0. They're an early player in this field. And like I said, they invested $100 billion into it in the SoftBank Vision Fund 1 with the Saudis. And then when the Khashoggi journalist was murdered in the Istanbul embassy, the stock price went way down. People were angry about that. They had no idea. But I don't know, you start mixing up business relations and with the Middle East, and things go sideways pretty quick, it seems. But anyways, the good and the bad. We're going to begin with the good. And this is ITOCHU and SoftBank invest in pioneering nuclear fusion startup, BLF. And this comes to us from JakotaIndex.com. And let's take a look. The strategic investment in Blue Laser Fusion aims to harness innovative laser technology for clean, stable energy production by 2030. ITOCHU and SoftBank are making strategic investments in Blue Laser Fusion, a U.S.-based nuclear fusion startup, signaling a significant commitment from Japanese private sector giants to cutting-edge clean energy technology. BLF, Blue Laser Fusion, which aims for a commercial launch in 2030, that's the SDG goals, by the way, and as we get into the next article about SoftBank, is this a... is this where the vocabulary hits the rubber, which meets the road? Anyways, it's at the forefront of developing a novel approach to stable electricity generation through its proprietary laser infusion technology, a method that promises a breakthrough in sustainable nuclear fusion. You got to put sustainable in there. 2030, sustainable. I see it. Do you? The company, founded by Nobel laureate Shuji Nakamura, who is celebrated for his invention of blue light-emitting diodes, has made notable progress since its establishment in November 2022. Within a year, BLF attracted substantial funding, raising approximately 5.6 billion yen, or $37.5 million, from venture capitalists and investors, highlighting the high confidence in its technology. BLF's technique focuses on laser intensification within a vacuum, a unique strategy that avoids heat generation and stands as an unprecedented method worldwide. This pioneering technology not only aims to meet the growing demand for clean energy driven by the expansion of artificial intelligence and the increasing power needs of data centers, but also aligns with the national energy strategies of Japan and the U.S., both of which emphasize the importance of nuclear fusion. This is, of course, considered to be a reversal on the nuclear position of SoftBank. SoftBank, I think that was in a different news article. SoftBank had apparently not been so keen on nuclear energy. I'm not sure about like the giant nuclear power plants we got on the fault lines in Japan. Maybe those are bad, but the new modular nuclear smaller power plants that are also being developed for submarines, also being developed for aircraft carriers, I don't see them blowing up a lot, and they travel around and they're pretty mobile. I wonder if we could have like a network of those powering small cities and research centers and stuff like that. And instead of just saying we need to centralize into these giant rods just an intense amount of nuclear energy into these fault lines, which, of course, not a good idea. But moving forward, the modular ones might be pretty cool. SoftBank Nuclear Technology. Let me just research that. SoftBank sees fusion as a promising option for clean energy. Okay, I'm not going to go into it. I can't remember where I read it. But anyway, so it's kind of neat that SoftBank would be taking a different approach to nuclear moving forward, not viewing it as the debacle of Fukushima, which we remember today. I mean, I remember watching on TV the top blowing off of that sucker. And it's like, it's only a couple hundred kilometers away from where I was at the time. And I'm going, I'm living at a time in my life where a couple hundred kilometers away, nuclear power plants are exploding. And I got out of town for a week and then I came back and I'm fine so far, but I'm not sure if it's fine up there, to be honest. I'm not exactly sure what's going on, but I tell you this, something is up. Something is going on. Now we get to the bad part of SoftBank. This is bad, bad, bad. I've noticed that as the coronavirus kind of ebbs into the past, a lot of the bad actors are also kind of in those waters that are behind us now, or are they? Like Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum and all that stuff. Like, I was like, I read COVID-19, The Great Reset, because Amazon suggested it to me, because when I was a research when I was teaching at SoftBank, I followed the Davos Club closely because of their interest in artificial intelligence. And I never viewed it as like some evil cabal set out to, you know, chip me and then make me eat bugs all the time. And so when I saw COVID-19, The Great Reset by Klaus Schwab, I was like, well, that's a weird book. I thought this guy was like an economist. And I read it and I was like, now is a complete opportunity to invest in, you know, like a weird Arnold Schwarzenegger accent and control mechanisms that make the world a better place by controlling everybody. And we respond by having WHO come in and in special groups parachute into areas using IoT to detect virus in people. I'm like, this sounds whacked out. And it's like COVID-19, The Great Reset. Let's join that guy. And that's what everybody did. Like Davos, World Economic Forum, they all go to Davos. Like, now we're making the world a better place with this guy called Klaus Schwab, who wrote the book, COVID-19, The Great Reset. It's like, I'm not sure if I want to be getting in on that dude, guys. Even though they're well-funded and they have a lot of intelligentsia apparently attracted to them, they are so caught in their ideological struggles, I don't see them being able to produce anything of value. They're parasites, essentially, coming in and trying to commandeer the technology and tell everybody else how to use it for their own benefit. And I really don't believe them. So this came as a shock to me. And this comes to us from softbanknews.jp/English-EN. 2024's World Economic Forum annual meeting was held in January, as we know, and this year's program featured AI House Davos. Again, this is not a breaking news podcast. I try to find things from the recent past that are affecting decisions now that might have implications for our future. That's kind of the way it goes. So it's fine to go back a couple of months in the past to kind of go, oh, look at what happened back there and look at what's happening now. Is that going to happen in the future? So this AI House Davos is a new initiative that brought leaders in the industry, civil society, government, the investing community, and academia together to drive the global conversation on AI. Doesn't that sound so douchey? We're the engineers. The Institute for AI and Beyond, a world-class AI research institute established by the University of Tokyo, which is a captured establishment in my view, SoftBank and others, was an initiator of the forum, and SoftBank was a contributor. And there's more about it there. I'll be linking it up at MatthewPMBigelow.com. And it kind of goes into like how awesome they are and what they're trying to do. The president of the University of Tokyo, Teruo Fuji served as moderator for a roundtable discussion on AI and higher education. The panel featured Eng Chee Tan, president of Singapore's University, National University of Singapore, Irene Tracy, vice chancellor of the University of Oxford, Kohei Ito, president of Keio University, and Paul Alivisatos, president of the University of Chicago. So these are like heavy hitters in the educational fields worldwide. And they're all at the Davos going, what can we do for AI? With SoftBank? What? The panelists addressed challenges posed by generative AI and how the technology can be used in higher education. AI governance and safety is another thing that they discovered. What was the thing that I really wanted to focus on? What we covered previously on the podcast, and it's mentioned here, is the AI Governance and Safety G7 Hiroshima AI process, which surveyed AI regulations and governance. And Arisa Emma, associate professor at Tokyo College, the University of Tokyo, moderated that type of session. And they talked about how to advance international cooperation for the responsible deployment of AI. What is that? So you have like at the university level, trying to collaborate with each other to, I guess, make programs that would make engineers joining those programs facilitate certain types of outcomes. I mentioned it's a captured thing, and that's the way I view it. They're trying to capture the engineers and facilitate them into World Economic Forum Davos agendas, which include COVID-19, The Great Reset, the book written by Klaus Schwab, who's founded the World Economic Forum. And so I'm not going to go too much into it there. The members of the panel noted that not all countries are utilizing AI in the same way, and that interoperability is crucial when it comes to discussions on AI governance and rules, standardization, right, across the board. It was also pointed out that to advance the implementation of AI governance, it will be necessary to coordinate discussions among different stakeholders. That's a World Economic Forum, Stakeholder Capitalism, another book by Klaus Schwab. And accordingly, there is a need for cooperation among international organizations like the G7 and the UN, the private sector, and standardization bodies. SoftBank. I think that's all it manages. So SoftBank is a contributor for this. And again, I would advise SoftBank to turn tail and run. Get out while you still can. These people are creepy and weird. They're parasites, and they will only lead you down the AI bridge to nowhere. We're going to finish today's segment here with probably the most important development in AI right now. And the way I view it is that most of AI right now, it's settled. The technology is already there. It's developed. It's being improved step by step, incrementally. But what we're seeing now is how do the regulatory bodies approve such projects, and how does it settle into the market? And we're taking a look right now at a dystopian vision of a future that we all knew would be arriving. And this one comes to us from NEC. It's not a press release, like sometimes what I was reading there. It's from robostart.info. It's a Japanese site, and I'm going to use the Google translation here. It's usually fine for this type of stuff because it's technical-based. Now, if you are running a factory and you are the boss, would you like to put cameras in place, or they're already in place, you just they're feeding into a computer, and you put a program into the computer that analyzes efficiency amongst your workers. And you have a computer vision program now that analyzes where people are walking, how they are working, how often they're on the work floor, how often they're not on the work floor. And it will automatically categorize your workforce into efficiency standards that you would like to set up. Because you're not sure, that person's a nice person and they're always nice to me and they look hard, working hard when I'm around them. But what if I go to my office and you go to your office and you look, type in their name and it searches their biometric data throughout your security camera systems. And you notice that person suddenly becomes 90% more efficient whenever you're around and their efficiency levels drop off like a cliff. Whenever you just leave the room, you might go, that person's a phony. I'm not going to promote that person. But there's another person that's always kind of quiet. They don't really seem to be working hard, but they're always kind of there. And then you type their name or their employee number into your database. You're like, wow, that person might not be the best worker, but look how efficient they are. If you were a boss at a company and you're like, now I don't have to walk around. I can just sit my ass on my computer typing in names and tallying up efficiency rates and checking them against the computer to see if they work or not. Would you do it? Well, now you can. NEC commercializes, quote, manufacturing DX, that's digital transformation, acronym designated by the government of Japan, manufacturing DX video AI analysis solution that automatically recognizes and measures time of human work from camera images at manufacturing sites. I'll be posting some of these images up at MatthewPMBigelow.com. And this is, of course, from a Japanese website. So there's only going to be this English version that I'm going to read to you available in the whole world. In preparation for the DX transformation of manufacturing sites, NEC has launched the IIoT, the Industrial Internet of Things, is a prime example for dystopian future that you've all envisioned that you think is like happening in China. It's happening in the manufacturing process right now worldwide. And it's not going to stop. It's going to keep going. Good luck. Have you heard about this before? It's already implemented. It's the first time you're hearing about it. If you were going to stop it, you'd have stopped it years ago. It's not stopping. In preparation for the DX transformation of manufacturing sites, NEC has launched the NEC Modo Zukuri DX Video AI Analysis Solution, which uses video recognition AI to automatically recognize the work content of people and measure time from videos taken at manufacturing sites. NEC Manufacturing DX Video AI Analysis Solution utilizes NECs, and NEC is one of the best facial recognition developers in the world. They're very good, very, very good. Utilizes NEC's unique video recognition AI that integrates multiple video recognition AIs. This would be like gait, this would be heat, this would be facial, this would be expressions, this would be... anyways, a few different. Because the AI is trained in advance about people, products, tools, etc., no additional learning is required for the company that implements it. That's their idea. I disagree with that last part. And it is possible to create detection models for various tasks with no code and with simple mouse operations. This makes it possible to efficiently and comprehensively visualize human work regardless of the manufacturing format or manufacturing site environment, realizing optimization of personnel allocation and work procedures, improving productivity and stabilizing quality. The company says it will contribute to improved safety and so on. It goes on from there. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's more of a visual idea. So if you are interested in that, you can go to MatthewPMBigelow.com for more. There's also the graphic user interface, and it's for managers, so you don't have to have a bunch of coders going on there. It looks really fascinating, and it's like... it's like a platform for your dystopia. It's dystopian platform efficiency for the boss. Now, what I predict is going to happen is that there's going to be anomalies because AI is never perfect. It makes motivated people assemble things more accurately, but it makes lazy people let things slide because you just trust the AI. And that even might be part of the idea here. It wasn't me. You could say to your boss, if this is implemented at your factory, it was the AI. How am I supposed to know what the AI is doing? You think I'm AI? And they might say, well, you're supposed to be monitoring. I was monitoring, but look, the AI told me that percentage right there. I went with the AI. It was the AI. So you could easily go both ways with this. And the people that go the lazy route and just let the AI take over, you're going to see like massive efficiency reported by the AI go way, way up. But the workers are going to figure out ways to skirt the cameras or face away or fake movements and fake efficiency tallying procedures. So the manager is going to not check those videos and go, hey, those people are gaming the system. I understand it, but I'll go talk to them about it. They're just going to go, wow, look at all this efficiency, without realizing that they're being played for the lazy suckers that they are. So again, if you're interested in that, that is MatthewPMBigelow.com. Dystopian in a box for your productivity measurements at the factories where we're all going to be working. Training the AI to train us to be better employees so that when the robots come, we train them. Japan Society 5.0. Thank you. Arigato, Mr. Roboto.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society.
What?
Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom.
Oh.
Society 5.0, a technology-based, human-centered society.
What?
The fourth industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face.
What?
It will, for example, free us from the stress of driving.
So I wonder why all these, all these corporations that are all in on these bureaucratic systems that are coming up in the AI space that just suck all the money and talent and make people think about like responsible AI governance ahead of the AI even doing anything. And I'll be covering this on the next podcast, I've decided, but even stuff like this AI program made a video of a politician and it said something fake. We need to control it now. It's like, what? I was looking at something like this. I put my name into AI and it came back with lies. It can't be trusted. It's like, why would you trust somebody's large language model, a text generator from the news? Do you know how much fake news is out there? Do you know how these large language models will scrape, have like a database of like a billion presets or a billion parameters? And you go, wow, that's crazy. Do you think that humans checked each of those billion parameters for your large language models to make sure that there was no non-facts in there that are often reported by the press? Like, even for example, something like the jobs reports coming out of the United States, it's like billion new jobs, just for example. And then like the next month is like, correction, minus 200,000 jobs. The amount of people reporting on a billion new jobs is going to be 1,000x compared to the correction about that. So if you're just using news to scrape the internet for your large language models, guess what? You're going to get a lot of fake news in there. So why are people like so upset about this? It's like, I put my name into this AI content generator and it fed me lies. It's like, well, maybe we shouldn't be trusting. Why would you think that it's going to spit back the truth? Why would you expect an AI thing to know you? I don't understand that idea. Maybe I just covered it. Let's take a look next at why not promoting the Japan What podcast. You can go to PayPal. That's paypal.me/JapanWUT. paypal.me/JapanWUT. We are also part of the podcasting 2.0 infrastructure. These are people developing apps that allow users to transfer or listeners or Bitcoin payments called Satoshis from their GetAlbi wallet directly to podcasters such as me. There's no middleman. And it's also expanded into the music industry where musicians and individual artists can upload their songs onto websites like lnbeats.com or wavelake.com. And there's these new podcasts featuring music DJs that will gather songs from these sites and then put them onto these podcast apps like Podverse, Fountain app, and more. And when you donate your Bitcoin, it automatically gets split to the host and to the musician with no middleman in between. It's an amazing new technology. It's only just coming up, and I suggest you get on it ASAP. You can go to MatthewPMBigelow.com to send me some traffic, check out the links and more, and thank you for supporting the show. All right, moving on. We got to do some promos sometimes. Let's take a look. We're going to look at migration for today. We got to do migration. Migration, let's go.
Here we go.
So I've been listening to a lot to a war reporter. His name is Michael Yon, and he's been reporting from a multitude of places around the world on the migration issue, especially when it comes to other players around the world, such as Iran, Hezbollah, China, and so on and so forth. And this comes back to Japan in a very real way, because Michael Yon spends a lot of time in Central America, and he's famous for putting the Darien Gap onto the map. There's no roads there, and it connects South America to North America, essentially, or Central America. And the migrants use this as a way to get into America, to get into Central America, and then use networks to get to the American border and then into America. So he's been covering this again and again and again. And I've watched a lot of documentaries now from other people who are south of the American border. And one thing that always stands out is that there is a UN presence there, especially something called the IOM. I think that means the International Organization of Migrants. I'm just going off the top of my dome here. And on a recent post on X, Michael Yon said, if the IOM is in your country, be suspicious. So the International Organization for Migration, yes, I was right. And so I was like, wow, I wonder what's going on in Japan. So I looked up IOM and Japan, and I found a whole bunch of articles. So we're going to go through them, because I wonder if I should go through this. I'll put the ending first. I was going to make it like a big, giant gotcha, like at the end. And look what happened here. So I'm going to open up my last thing here. This comes to us from the Mainichi, Japan's national daily since 1922. And it says, this is the headline. Remember, Japan is supposed to be the country that hates foreigners, never allows migration, yada, yada, yada. But under the Abe administration, they announced a plan to have 500,000 interns or workers or skilled, non-skilled workers come into Japan from over a period of 5 years. And then on March 5th, 2024, it says on the Mainichi, Japan's national daily since 1922, up to 820,000 foreign specified skilled workers expected in Japan from FY 2024. If we called them migrants, Japanese people might not like it, but because there's a labor shortage due to a severe plummeting population, calling them specified skilled workers might be a way to get the Japanese to accept such things. But anyways, up to 820,000 foreign specified skilled workers expected in Japan from FY 2024. Now, I'm going to go back to the beginning of this segment here, and this comes to us from the IOM. So we can think that the end result of all these meetings is the news about, wow, surprise, how did this happen? 820,000? Wow, this must have just... Japanese people must be just wishing this. But let's begin. This comes to us from iom.int. And this is called Making Migration Work for All. Japan bolsters IOM global appeal with USD 32 million for humanitarian and climate actions. So we're getting in on the climate cult. This comes to us on Tokyo, 9th of February, 2024. The government of Japan has dispersed $32 million USD to support a wide range of operations to be implemented by the International Organization for Migration in 2024, in line with IOM's Global Appeal 2024. You can look at that if you want. The funding will enable IOM to help migrants, displaced persons, returnees, and communities affected by crises, conflict, and climate change in 24 countries. You can use that as an excuse for anybody, can't you? And notice how they always have the C. Crises, conflict, and climate change. You think that's an accident? Maybe not. The largest single country allocation of USD $6.5 million goes to war-affected Ukraine to support the health sector. More than half of the Japanese contribution will help the IOM's assistance to vulnerable people affected by conflicts and disasters in sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and North Africa. In Asia, the funding will assist communities affected by climate change and other vulnerable populations on the move. In the Philippines and Timor-Leste, where the El Nino phenomenon is bringing more hazards than the past years, the funding will allow IOM to assist the governments to better respond to emergencies. The government of Japan is a long-standing and committed partner of IOM, especially in the field of humanitarian assistance. So we kind of set it up there. Japan's funding it. It doesn't really seem like it's for Japan, but they're still on board with the mission, as it were. But let's take a look at the next link I have here. And this comes to us from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan, the website, mofa.go.jp, an official government website. Mr. Tsuge Yoshifumi, State Minister for Foreign Affairs, attended International Forum of Acceptance of Foreign Nationals and Their Integration into Japan. So on the first one, the donation one, was from February 9th. And then on February 27th, they have a meeting after donating $32 million. Mr. Tsuge Yoshifumi, I don't want to mistake your name, sir. The State Minister for Foreign Affairs attended the International Forum on Acceptance of Foreign Nationals and Their Integration into Japan, bad name, co-hosted by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the International Organization for Migration. The overview is as follows. One, in his opening remarks, the minister referred to the theme of this year's forum, support for learning and career development of foreign children, and stated that with the increase in the number of foreign residents and multinationalization, comprehensive support for foreign children is not only important for their growth, but also meaningful from a diplomatic point of view. Sure. The state minister also took this opportunity to have a brief discussion with Ms. Amy E. Pope, Director General of the IOM, noting the outcome of the previous day's meeting between Ms. Kawakawa Yoko, Minister for Foreign Minister of Japan, and Ms. Pope, General Director of the IOM. The two agreed to continue their cooperation between Japan and the IOM. And at the forum, the following reports by Mr. Tsuge, the minister, a keynote speech by Ms. Pope and director of the IOM, and lectures by Japanese international experts were also given. So there we go. So now they're getting closer and establishing their commitments. And we all know where this ends, right? 820,000 workers. Next, we go to the Ministry of Justice on February 26th. So this was February. So we're going the day before. Courtesy visit to the Minister of Justice by the Director General of International Organization for Migration, IOM. So that's not much there, but it's just for effect. And then it comes up to the news reports after that. So this comes to us on March 8th, 2024. Japan considers doubling limit on skilled foreign workers. So is this tied in with the International Organization of Migration? It doesn't say it is, not at all, but this is from the Japan Times. The government is considering setting the cap on the number of foreign workers with special skills it accepts under a special residency status over 5 years from fiscal 2024 at more than 800,000. The limit will be raised to more than double the current 5-year gap, reflecting severe labor shortages in various sectors. And it says that those people then can apply to stay for longer periods. And then the Mainichi ones. There's another one too. This one's from the Nikkei. You can kind of see the difference here. Nikkei loves globalism. They're a globalist organization. This is their headline. Japan races to court foreign talent as it doubles skilled workers cap. And it just shows like a person wearing a mask. Her name is Dao. She might be from Thailand or Vietnam or China. I'm not sure. But they're just holding a giant sieve of noodles. Like they're working in a noodle shop. So, yeah, we really need to court foreign talent to make our noodles, don't we, Nikkei? They're always the most racist, aren't they? The most woke, the most on board. They're like, yeah, we love our skilled workers. They make our ramen. That's so disgusting. Give up your whole life to make us noodles. Come over here. I'm going to continue with the Mainichi because it's the most centrist. This goes back to the beginning. Up to an estimated 820,000 foreign specified skilled workers will be accepted in Japan. The figure is more than twice as many as that for a five-year period, which was set in 2019 when the specific skill visa was introduced. The visa status was created to help domestic industries cope with the worsening labor shortage. The government is further considering adding the motor vehicle transport, railroad, forestry, and lumber industries to the system, right? This is not your, we want a Kiowa hobbyists to teach our women English as the housewives have all this extra money. The government, I'll just say that, the motor vehicle transport, railroad, forestry, and lumber industries into the system. The estimates for the coming five-year period were made by the related agencies and ministries and include those industries. And I'm not sure how much I'm going to go into that. I'll just look up UN, IOM, nothing, and United Nations, nothing. So it doesn't mention those things. I mean, why would they? That would be a little bit weird because it would be admitting to the Japanese people that the Japanese government is kind of working in cahoots with the UN on their migration status. So we could also maybe like suggest something like, some of these people coming from these nations need skills, but they don't have the skills to develop because of climate change. So they need to come here to develop the skills so that they can go back to their home countries and prevent climate change. Like that's kind of how they could easily just say, and that's why it's 820,000 people, because that equals climate change. You know, that's just exactly how they do it. That's me going off on a tangent at the end there, but how else would you connect it to the IOM? You just include the two magic words that everybody loves, climate change. Why are you doing this? Dude, climate change. Oh, okay then. If I disagree with you, I'm a Nazi. So good. That's a good thing. Let's do it. Let's go. IOM. So that's kind of an interesting idea there that suddenly we have 820,000 people coming into Japan. And this comes on the heels of the Japanese government donating $32 million and saying they need to work more closely with the IOM to meeting with the IOM to then having a bunch of so-called specified skilled workers. Remember, we need those Chinese people holding giant sieves of noodles for a ramen here. That's why they're coming. That's why we need them, according to the Nikkei.
Here we go.
I think that's going to be about it for today. I think we're getting towards the end here. What I am going to do is I'm going to include a song that I recorded with a band a long time ago called the Dead Sea Dropouts. And this is just from a rehearsal, but I found it and I kind of like the performance. There's a couple of warts, but for the most part, I think it would be a very enjoyable listen. So we're going to play a song that we like to call Purim from the Dead Sea Dropouts and just a random rehearsal from probably 2018, 6 years ago now. And it's kind of Jewish music. It's called klezmer music. And we reappropriated it for Japanese needs as a group of foreigners and Japanese people playing music all those years ago. So I'm going to play that song and I'll come back to you and bring it in. Thank you. All right, you found it. The Japan What Podcast, episode 139, coming at you from the Tomihisacho Studios in Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan. Till next time, everybody, go to MatthewPMBigelow.com and ja, mata ne. MatthewPMBigelow.com. Donate. Send me traffic. I need it.